Well, thank you very much for coming today. Today, I was going to talk about the life of Buddha. There's a very beautiful Zen center here. I got here for the service, and it went very well. Very wonderful service that they started off with before, and we had a breakfast, and so it was a great experience to come here. You were told, I am a teacher at Dharma Field. I'm an assistant teacher over there, the head teacher Steve Hagen. And anyway, I'm glad to have an opportunity to come here and meet with all of you. And I've been very impressed with what I've seen here so far. So, well, I was going to talk about the life of Buddha, as I mentioned, and Buddha was born about 2,500 years ago in northern India, and he wasn't called the Buddha until after he had his awakening experience at the age of 35. He was called Siddhartha, and his mother died shortly after he was born, and he was raised by his stepmother. His father was a powerful clan ruler, and he very much wanted Siddhartha to follow in his footsteps and take over as clan ruler when he became old enough. And so Siddhartha was educated with that in mind. He received an education that would enable him to govern the affairs of a large clan, and he also had extensive training in the martial arts. From a very early age, he showed a great deal of sensitivity to suffering. He noticed the suffering that went on with the little animals that he saw, particularly in one instance where he was watching the spring planting. And this was a supposedly a joyful event where they would have a ceremonial plowing of the fields, where this was the ceremony to start the spring planting. But although it's supposedly a joyful event, he was noticing the destruction of the little animals' homes in the soil as the plow disturbed the soil. He noticed how the little animals' homes were destroyed and how other animals would come in and eat the smaller animals, and bigger animals would eat those animals. He saw this as an event in which it's traditionally thought of as being a very joyful event, but he saw all the suffering involved in it, all the problems and confusion and difficulty within it. And he had this deep sensitivity to the suffering of others, and his father was concerned about this. His father felt that his sensitivity to suffering might interfere with his ability to be a successful clan ruler. He thought, you know, because clan rulers had to sometimes lead their troops into battle to defend their territory and annex neighboring territories, his father felt that his sensitivity to suffering and his concern for the welfare of others might interfere with his ability to carry out his duties as a clan ruler. So his father tried to shelter Siddhartha from the unpleasant aspects of life, tried to shelter him from the suffering that he saw in the world, and he tried to create pleasurable circumstances for Siddhartha to be involved in. So he tried to distract Siddhartha from the suffering that he might see, and also provide lots of pleasurable activities for him to be involved in, lots of parties and festivals and wonderful events. Siddhartha was very good in his studies. He was an excellent athlete, and he was very popular among the people of the clan, and they all looked forward to the time when he would take over as the clan ruler. But as he got older, he wondered more and more about the suffering that he saw in the world, and he felt that he had to really get to the bottom of it and see what it was about. And he realized he couldn't go forth to be to take over the rulership of the clan. So at the age of 29, he left the palace, went out to become a homeless wanderer, a homeless truth seeker, and he devoted his life to trying to try to get to the bottom of all this suffering that he saw in the world. And he studied with some of the best teachers, some of the best religious teachers of his time. And he very quickly mastered their philosophies and meditation techniques, but he wasn't satisfied with what he'd learned. He still felt that their teachings and practices didn't get down to helping him resolve the questions that he had about suffering. So although these teachers were very impressed with him and his ability to learn quickly and do well and they're following their teachings and practices, Siddhartha decided he needed to leave them. And he looked for another way to try and resolve his questions about suffering. The next thing he turned to was the practice of asceticism. And with asceticism, it's a program of self-denial and sometimes self-torture, where a practitioner will try to intentionally make things difficult on himself in order to purify his body and mind and to enable him to realize the truth and to realize thereby the freedom from suffering. But Siddhartha tried this, and he tried it so diligently that he almost killed himself. Fortunately, a milkmaid found him at the side of a road. He passed out from exhaustion and lack of food and sleep, and he was close to death, but fortunately the milkmaid was able to revive him. She gave him cereal and milk and brought him back to health. And when he recovered from this experience, he realizes asceticism was not the path. It was not going to be helpful to him in realizing the truth and being released from suffering. So what he came upon by himself was the practice of awareness here and now. And he tried to carry out this practice in all circumstances. And he did a lot of what is called Zazen. This is the most stable and peaceful form of this practice of here-now awareness. And it was while he was sitting in the Zazen posture that he had a great experience of awakening, and his questions about suffering were resolved, and he greatly realized the truth. So during this, while he was sitting Zazen, he experienced lots of things before his awakening. He experienced some things that were very frightening. Lots of terrifying things came up. He experienced lots of very beautiful and seductive experiences. But he was determined not to get distracted from his full awareness of here-now experience, and whenever he'd get caught by these experiences, he would quickly resume the practice of full awareness here and now. And eventually he had an awakening experience. And in this awakening experience, he realized that his true self, his true nature, was the Buddha nature, awareness or awakeness itself. He realized that the true life, the true self, the true nature of all beings, not only himself, but all beings, was this Buddha nature, or awareness, or awakeness. It became evident that all the seemingly separate beings that he experienced were manifestations of this true life, true nature, or true self. Of the true life or true self of Buddha, and each seemingly separate being is the life of all beings. The same with us. It's our life is the life of all beings. We live inseparably from all beings. This true life, true self, true nature is a reality of wholeness and totality. Our true life is a universal reality. And we're all living this one universal life. And for the next 45 years until his death at the age of 80, Buddha, he was called Buddha at this time because he was awake. Buddha means the awakened one. He was awake to who he truly was. He was awake to the true nature of him, his life, and the true nature of all beings' life. So for the next 45 years, he tried to help his followers to eventually realize who they truly were and to live as they truly were. He tried to help them live as this awakeness that is their true life. So this true life or true self, this is our practice, is to live as this true life or true self, to live as the Buddha nature, that is our life. Excuse me. So our practice is to live as we truly are. The practice is to live as the true self, to live as the true self is the essence of Buddhist practice. The true self is usually ignored or overlooked, and it's overlooked or ignored by being caught up in dualistic, limited, one-sided views. And when we're caught up in dualistic, one-sided, limited views, we tend to act with egocentric intention, believing we're separate ego selves living in a divided up reality. We don't realize our inseparability from all beings, and we act based on trying to benefit the separate ego selves we imagine ourselves to be. We act with egocentric intention. And our practice is to see and let go of how our true life or true self is ignored, and fully live as the true self, to see when we're caught up in our dualistic, one-sided, limited ideas about who we are and what we are, and to allow that to drop away and to fully live as awakeness, awareness, Buddha nature, or true self that we are. A true self isn't something that can be seen objectively or understood conceptually, but it's being directly experienced here and now, and everything is a manifestation of it. By directly experiencing it, I mean it's the experience. Before we overlay it with our ideas and beliefs about what the experience is, so this true self can't be seen objectively or understood conceptually, but it's being directly experienced here and now. Everything is a manifestation of it. In this sense, it can't be hidden. It's all of us are experiencing it right now. Our direct experience is the same as a Buddha's direct experience. The difference is that Buddhas don't get caught up in their ideas and beliefs as we do. But all of us are experiencing this true self. All of us are living as this awakeness or Buddha nature. Buddha taught that all beings are living interdependently, living inseparably from each other. And in our practice, we try to take care of all the seemingly separate beings without being taken in by the belief that they actually are separate beings. We still function in a reality which looks like separate me and separate others, but we don't hold rigidly to that idea. We just function in that reality where there seems to be a dualistically structured, divided-up reality, but without being caught by the belief that it really is a divided-up reality. We try to realize what our life is without being caught up in our ideas about it and fully live this reality that is being directly experienced now. Everything that we meet is our own life in the sense that we live inseparably from it. So, since we're inseparable from everything we meet, from every being we meet, to hurt others is to hurt ourselves, and to help others is to help ourselves. This realization of our inseparability from all beings is the basis of compassion. If we really realize we're inseparable from others, then that awakens a desire to try to be kind and compassionate to others. Each being we meet is our own life. We try to respect each being and take care of them, seeing that they're our own life. And each being is expressing this universal reality of Buddha nature in their own unique way. Each being is great beyond comparison in this sense, in that beyond any idea we might have about them, beyond any preconceived ideas we might have about them, where we categorize them as important or unimportant or good or bad or worthy or unworthy. You know, reality shows up. It looks like we can make these distinctions, but if we look carefully, we can't really find these distinctions as actual, real, separate categories. So everything we meet, we try to take care of it in the best way. We try to take care of it with kindness and compassion and take care of it with the realization that whatever we meet is our own life. This doesn't mean to be nice to everybody. Sometimes the best thing you can do and the kindest thing you can do is to speak in such a way as to help someone realize that they're going in the wrong direction. We might need to offer criticism, or we might need to physically restrain some people who are confused about what they're doing. It doesn't mean to just be nice to everybody, but to care. It means to care about others and to realize we're inseparable from others. Every being we meet is our own life. And we try to put this into practice in our everyday life as much as we can. Buddha offered three pure precepts. These are avoid what is unwholesome, do what is wholesome, and consider the welfare of all beings in everything we do. Avoid what is unwholesome. Avoid living your life based on ignoring wholeness. Our life is wholeness in that we're inseparable from all beings. And so we try to avoid acting based on ignoring that our life is wholeness. It said, do what is wholesome. Live our life based on the realization that we're living inseparably from all beings. Every being is our own life. Try to be kind and compassionate to all the beings we meet. And the third is try to consider the welfare of all beings in everything we do. Everything we meet is our own life. Our life is inseparable from all beings. Try to live our life in such a way that we benefit all beings, not just the beings that we can see, but all beings. We're inseparable from all beings, whether they're right here or, you know, near, far, past, present, future. Our life includes all beings, not just the ones that we happen to objectively see now. And what we can't see all beings objectively, as this is a boundless reality. We're inseparable from. We can't see it as an object separate from us. We can't understand it conceptually. We can't get this life of all beings into a conceptual package. It's a boundless, all-inclusive life. But we can live this life. And to live it is to see how we ignore it and to let that go and resume the practice of really living this life. So the three pure precepts point to that. They point to helping us to see when we're caught up in our limited views and in ignoring that our life is wholeness and ignoring that our life is inseparable from the life of all beings. Buddha also offered a list of prohibitory precepts. Sometimes people think of these as being commandments, but they're not actually commandments. They're pointers to help us see when we're ignoring who we truly are, helping us to see when we're caught up in egocentricity and acting in a way that is harmful to ourselves and others. These prohibitory precepts include these are activities that should be avoided. These are killing, stealing, lying, satisfying desires in a harmful way, slandering others, abusing others, being greedy, being boastful, overindulging in intoxicants, and harboring anger and ill will towards others. Also, Buddha encouraged the cultivation of the virtues of kindness, generosity, compassion, diligence, patience, equanimity, joyfulness, and fearlessness. These virtues naturally arise and develop as the Buddha way is carried out. The Buddha way, the way of awakeness, the way of living is the awakeness that we are. As the Buddha way is carried out, it becomes clearer and clearer that we're living inseparably from others, and we can live our life we can become more compassionate and generous and kind-hearted and patient, and live our life with equanimity and joyfulness and fearlessness. So I'll say a little more. I have till 10:20. Okay, I'll try and step on the gas here a little. Well, another teaching of the Buddha's was the teaching of impermanence. Buddha taught that the reason there's so much suffering and confusion in the world is because we usually overlook or ignore our interdependence with others, and we overlook the truth of impermanence. And nothing remains the same, even for a moment. In actual direct experience, nothing separate or persisting can be found that could be grasped. This is usually ignored or overlooked, and people usually live their lives trying to chase after and grasp ungraspable things and situations. So Buddha encouraged his followers in the practice of awareness to here-now experience. This was a great practice that he carried out when he was practicing Zazen and when he, in his daily life. It is a practice that led to his great awakening. So he encourages followers in the practice of awareness or awakeness to here-now experience. He encouraged them to live their lives based on awareness to direct here-now experience rather than living their lives based on their preconceived ideas and one-sided beliefs. Buddha taught in many ways. He tried to help each being appropriately and adjusted his teachings according to the capacities of the people he was speaking to. Buddha also encouraged questioning. He warned people not to blindly accept what they hear from him or from anybody. He also said don't immediately reject it either. You know, sometimes you might hear something and it sounds ridiculous, but he said, don't immediately reject it. Just reflect on these teachings and ask questions about them, consider them. As much as possible, don't grasp them or hold to them, believing this is truth that I should hold to. And believe in unquestioningly. When we're using words, we can't really say. We can't really express truth using words. The dualistic language concepts aren't able to completely express the truth. But yet, words and language concepts can be very helpful as pointers. They can point us in the direction of realizing what truth is, but they're not meant to be grasped and believed in unquestioningly. Many people became Buddha's followers because he had so deeply realized his interdependence with others. Because he'd so deeply realized his interdependence with others, he had a very peaceful and kind-hearted presence. Others could feel his peacefulness and compassion and were drawn to him. Also, Buddha saw very clearly, and he spoke skillfully and was able to adjust his teachings to be helpful to each unique situation and individual. So but do you have any questions about any of this? I want to let you have time for questions.
Silly question.
Yeah.
Did Buddha ever get married?
He was before he left home. He got married. And he had a child, and they were staying at the palace together, his father's palace. But the intensity of his need to get to the bottom of what this suffering was motivated him to leave. He knew his family would be taken care of at the palace. There were many people there who could take care of his wife and son, but it was, he felt he had to do it. He loved his wife and son very much, but he felt he had to go. Later on, after he had had his experience and had been practicing with his followers, his monk followers for a number of years, he came back to the kingdom, and he... his son was a little boy then, and he brought his little boy along with him to be trained as a monk, and also his wife became one of Buddha's nuns later too. So it wasn't as if he'd abandoned them. It wasn't like he was a deadbeat dad or anything. But he deeply cared about them, but he felt that he had to get to the bottom of this. This was such a deep issue for him that he had to look into it very, very completely. Does that address your question?
Yeah, yeah.
Good, okay. All right, yes.
Thank you. What's known about the end of the Buddha's life and his death?
The end of his life? Well, he continued, I'll just say a little bit about his life before he died. He continued to live the life of a wandering monk who would be supported by offerings from people. And he'd travel around from place to place and offer teachings. And he traveled all over India, he mostly northern India. And he had many followers. Many followers came to him. When he was almost 80, he became very sick, and he realized he wasn't going to be able to continue, and he realized he was close to death. He was, they don't know exactly what it was, but he was having horrible vomiting of blood, and he was very sick, and he lay down between two trees, and he passed away. And but his teaching spread throughout India and through neighboring countries, and now his teachings are spreading throughout the world, a lot of this, especially with the internet, lots of information about Buddha and his teachings. Did that address your question?
Thank you.
Yeah. But along the way, he met all kinds of people and offered teachings that were appropriate in accordance with the circumstances that the people were living their lives. He even had talks to businessmen, to talk to them how they could be businessmen and be good businessmen. He'd talk about setting aside a portion of their income and setting aside money for their retirement, money for their family, and also for helping the community. He tried to, you know, make teachings relevant to everybody, not just monks, but and children and people of all walks of life, people who were untouchables, and people who were royalty. And so he tried, whoever he met, he tried to offer appropriate teaching. There was one person who, he was a garbage man, he was one of the untouchables, and he felt ashamed. He said, I'm a lowly untouchable, I'm a lowly garbage man. And he felt, I don't want to go near the Buddha because I'm not worthy of going near the Buddha. I'm just a garbage man, you know. So whenever he'd see the Buddha coming, he would run away. but Buddha would always find him. So eventually Buddha was able to convince him to become one of his monks, and this person went on to become one of Buddha's wonderful disciples. So this story has special meaning to me. I'm a little choked up about it because I was a garbage man, you know. So anyway, Buddha talked to everybody, you know. And he deeply respected everybody, no matter what their position was in human society, or no matter how their life was going on. So anyway, I really like that story because I was a garbage man, and I like stories about other garbage men. That's really Dogen's. Some of you are familiar with Dogen Zenji? His teacher, Ru Jing, was a garbage man, and so I really liked hearing the story about Ru Jing. And yes.
Thank you. That was a masterful telling of the story.
Well, thank you.
My recollection is that part of the story, or one version anyway, was that his final illness was caused by spoiled meat. Is that just one among many stories?
That is a possibility, yeah. Yeah, Buddha would occasionally eat meat if it was offered, you know. And it could have been that was the case. It might have been spoiled. It could have been some other spoiled food. It could have been he had some serious stomach problem too that had nothing to do with what he'd eaten. But that is true. There was that's one of the stories about how he became so sick towards the end. But the meat was given to him by a blacksmith named Kunda, and he didn't want people saying to Kunda, well, "You gave Buddha bad food." You know. so he told Kunda, "You know, it was a great meritorious deed that you gave the last meal to the Buddha." And he wanted people to really be nice to Kunda and not blame him for having given the Buddha spoiled meat. That's one version. There could be a number of versions. But he was concerned about Kunda. He didn't want people saying, "You killed the Buddha." He didn't want
that. So stories like that, are they handed down verbally? Things weren't written down. Like,
no, these are passed down verbally, and the stories change.
The person's name and the garbage man and all that.
Yeah.
It could be
something made up, but these stories are around. We don't know how many are true or how many are not. But these stories have shown up, and some people derive inspiration from these stories. Okay. Like I derived inspiration from the garbage man story. So yes.
I know that his stepmother became his disciple.
And right.
But we don't know anything about what happened to his father or if he had any male siblings that had followed him. Who ruled after?
Well, his father continued to rule. And his father, I think he was able to pass the kingdom on to, or the clan rulership on to somebody else. But his father eventually became a disciple of the Buddha, too. He deeply appreciated his teachings.
Was the Buddha literate? Was there writing at that time?
Yes. He was well-educated. I don't know how... things were communicated orally. They were... it was an oral tradition. The teachings for several hundred years were transmitted orally. So I don't know how much actual written literature there was at that time.
Well, he had a disciple who started writing.
Well, yeah, later on. Yeah. Though for several hundred years it was communicated verbally. So.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, the final days of the Buddha there must be really significant, because there's widespread depiction of the Buddha, a reclining Buddha.
Right, yeah.
Large statues.
Right.
Of the reclining Buddha. I wonder whether there's written what he said, his last testament.
Well, he... He said, all conditioned things are impermanent. Work out your salvation with diligence and care. And he wanted his monks to continue living their life as he had taught them. And and then he died peacefully.
I was particularly impressed there. There's a large... reclining Buddha there in Dongguan, northern China,
Yeah. Northern
Thailand, and then there's one, and I believe there's one in Burma.
Yeah, there's some very many wonderful statues of that, and he's always resting on his right side.
Yeah. Peaceful.
Yeah, very peaceful. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's probably, as I mentioned in my talk, his presence was very peaceful. He, because he so clearly saw it, he was inseparable from all beings. All beings could feel deep peace and compassion in his presence. And so, anyway, that in his dying, I'm sure that was also going on, feeling the deep peacefulness and presence of the Buddha. Okay.
One story is that Ananda was very...
I'm sorry, but...
One story at the end of his life, Buddha's life, is that Ananda, one of his beloved disciples, was very distressed.
Yeah.
And he said, Ananda, be a lamp unto yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, be a lamp unto yourself. Yeah. Betake yourself to no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth. Do not take refuge in anything external. Really live your life. You know, he wanted Ananda to really carry on with this practice of living this life of awakeness. And Ananda did. He was a great disciple of the Buddha. Yes?
What happened to Buddha's body after he died? Was he cremated? Is there a site where he's believed to be resting?
Yeah, he was cremated. And the cremated remains were divided up among, a number of different kingdoms, and they were, because many, you know, he traveled a lot of places, and many people in these different kingdoms revered him, so they divided up his remains among the people of these different, among the different kingdoms, and they would erect, they called them stupas, memorial towers, to honor the Buddha, and at the site where his remains were. Is that good? Okay.
Yes. I just have this one big question.
Okay.
I need to ask him. Because when I talk to Hindus or Indians from East India, they claim Buddha was born and died a Hindu. So, well, of course, it's the same as Jesus Christ, you know. Jesus Christ was a Jew, born and died a Jew. But the thing is, there are a lot of Buddhist practitioners who believe in reincarnation, which is a takeoff from Hinduism, right? So are there enough documentation to say that in the life of Buddha, he did believe in reincarnation, and he transmitted this to his disciples. And reincarnation is a big part of the Buddhist concept, or is it not?
Well, he didn't reject the idea because so many people in India at that time really believed very strongly in reincarnation. He didn't reject it. He, but he didn't really emphasize it too much either.
There are Buddhist practitioners who truly believe reincarnation.
Right, I know.
Especially in Asia.
Right, I know that. And it's... We don't say for or against. We don't believe there is reincarnation. We don't believe there isn't. You know, it's either way. It's a belief, and this isn't about taking hold of a belief. It's about realizing actual direct experience and living out of that, rather than holding to some belief there is reincarnation or there isn't. It's not about. This isn't a belief system in its ultimate sense, though many people treat it as a belief system.
Well, one thing he did is he reduced the influence of caste system.
Yes, he did.
That's very clear.
That's a good point. He like the garbage man that he, you know, he was a member of the lowest caste, but he wouldn't take into account what caste a person was from when they came into the order of monks. He just, you're a monk now. You know, it's nothing to do with caste. We're all equal. We're all living this universal life. We don't, there's nobody superior to another in an ultimate sense. So, yes, Buddha was very influential in, toning down the seriousness that people believed in the caste system. So.